The French far-right leader, Marine Le Pen, has been banned from running for public office for 5 years after being found guilty of embezzlement. She was also sentenced to 4 years in prison, half of it suspended. Allies of Ms. Le Pen said that democracy had been harmed by a court deciding who could and could not run for office, a claim that's been echoed by right-wing politicians elsewhere. Paul Moss reports.
Eric Ciotti is no ally of Marine Le Pen, but the former leader of a rival party. But even he was outraged by today's sentence, saying France's destiny had been confiscated by an outrageous judicial cabal. And right-wing leaders from Spain, France, Italy and the Netherlands denounced Marine Le Pen's sentence in similar terms, while Elon Musk warned that the court's decision would backfire. His ally, Donald Trump, has been a frequent critic of judges. Mr. Trump's supporters often claiming that the will of the people is being blocked by courts and by a broader unelected establishment.
A religious leader in Mandalay says the humanitarian situation in Myanmar's second city following Friday's earthquake is dire. People are camping out in the streets for a fourth night. Shaima Khalil reports.
The UN says the earthquake has compounded an already dire crisis in Myanmar with the ongoing civil war. Despite the destruction, there's been continuous bombardment by the ruling junta on the earthquake-hit region of Saigang against pro-democracy rebel groups. Hospitals in Myanmar are overwhelmed, and aid teams on the ground are contending with damaged roads, landslides and debris, and an active conflict. In Bangkok, 800 miles away from the epicenter, officials said that teams have been unable to detect more vital signs from those trapped in the rubble of the collapsed construction site.
Russia has sought to play down President Trump's remarks over the weekend that he's angry with Vladimir Putin after he criticized the credibility of President Zelensky. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said some of Mr. Trump's reported statements were not direct quotations, adding that President Putin remained open to talks with Mr. Trump. And, contradicting the US president, Mr. Peskov said there were no plans to hold a phone call between the two leaders this week. The BBC Russia editor described it as a diplomatic response from the Kremlin. A UN official has described Israel's killing of 8 Palestinian ambulance workers in Gaza as a flagrant and severe disregard of international law. Philippe Lazzarini, head of the UN's relief agency for Palestinian refugees, said such killings have become routine. The bodies of the 8 medics were found in shallow graves on Sunday. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says the number of people killed in Israeli strikes since the collapse of the ceasefire has passed 1,000. World News from the BBC.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Gustavo Cartinas's Crisis Knows No Borders at the North Street Cabaret on Saturday, April 12th at 8 p.m. Composer and percussionist Gustavo Cartinas brings melodic and uplifting compositions rooted in social justice. He is joined by Mark Feldman, John Arabagon, and Dave Miller. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
Election Day is around the corner next Tuesday. WORT has interviewed candidates for City Council, and we've put together a candidate guide with those interviews and more. Find it online at WORTFM.org/candidates and find what you need to be ready to vote. That's at myvote.wi.gov. Say it's my country.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I am your host, Andrew Thomas. I am normally behind the scenes on the soundboard for Monday's show with Douglas Haynes. But today I'm in the host chair to talk with Andrew S. Barish about his brand new book, Hating Jazz, A History of Its Disparagement, Mockery, and Other Forms of Abuse, published this year by the University of Chicago Press. Disclaimer, before we lose a number of listeners, both Andrew and I are big fans of jazz, so this won't just be a 50-minute roast of a musical genre so many of us love, and apparently many of us hate, too. I should also mention that today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be accepting phone calls. If you'd like to leave a comment about the show, however, you can message me directly at andrew.thomas@wartfm.org. In Hating Jazz, Andrew Barish focuses on those voices that have denounced, made fun of, and disparaged jazz over time to give us a more holistic picture of the music's complicated place in American cultural life. Jazz is a display of Black creativity and genius, an art form that is deeply embedded in African American life. Though the explicit racial tenor of jazz jokes has become muted over time, making fun of jazz, either in a lighthearted or aggressive way, is also an engagement with the place of Blackness in America. An individual's taste in music may seem personal, but Barish's analysis of jazz hatred demonstrates that musical preferences and trends are a social phenomenon. Criticism of jazz has become inextricable from the ways we understand race in America, past and present. Hating Jazz shows that our response to music can be a social act, unique to our historical moment and cultural context. We react to music in certain ways because of who we are, where we are, and when we are. The person making this fascinating argument is Andrew S. Barish, Associate Professor in the Department of Humanities and Cultural Studies at the University of South Florida. He is the author of Lonesome Roads and Streets of Dreams, Place, Mobility, and Race in Jazz of the 1930s and 40s, also published by the University of Chicago Press. Thank you for joining me today, Andrew, on A Public Affair. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's really great to be here. Thank you.
So I'd like to begin a little bit with definitional matters. And Andrew, you intentionally don't spend a lot of time defining the term jazz, and so we don't have to now either. But could you at least give our listeners a gloss on what our primary term jazz means in a few of the contexts that you write about?
Right. That's often been the central issue in jazz is, you know, what is this music? And it has meant lots of different things for lots of different people at different moments. So, you know, we tend to look back now and we kind of separate out the stuff that we kind of tell a coherent narrative, and there's Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Charlie Parker and John Coltrane, and, you know, and we create a story. But of course, in reality, jazz meant lots of things. When the music first emerged, there's some evidence that the term jazz sort of predates the music and it got sort of attached to the music. But it meant lots of different things. So it meant a variance of ragtime. It meant popular song with syncopated rhythms. It meant dance music of the time. So it meant lots of things. And that, when you read jazz history and you try to kind of keep the context in mind, you realize that it just meant lots of different things. So if you're going to talk about what people hated, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to say, you know, early on they hated Louis Armstrong because it was all sort of mashed together. It was, you know, in the 30s or late 20s, it would be you hate Paul Whiteman, who was a white band leader, or you maybe you don't like Louis Armstrong. So the terms have changed so much, and jazz is I think of it more like and lots of scholars think like this, that it's more like a field that people are playing in. And there's certain characteristics that are common. There's, to varying degrees, improvisation and indebtedness to Black musical practices, things like call and response and playing with the blues scale and blues notes and things like that. It was more realistic and more accurate to kind of just treat it very broadly and kind of look at each moment and say, what did jazz mean at that moment?
It's interesting because I feel like many people would be like, jazz, you know it when you hear it. And yet there's such a strong indeterminacy, like when we try and to describe it. And one of the things that you write is this indeterminacy is characteristic of jazz hating, and that it actually kind of fuels a lot of the frustrations with the genre.
Yeah, and you know, even the well-known Ken Burns series, which I think aired around 2000, there's some very poetic description at the beginning that I always found sort of fascinating, and it was, jazz is America, jazz is, you know, modernity, and jazz is the past, and jazz is the present, and, you know, jazz is white, and jazz is Black, and, you know, and it was just sort of everything, even within the jazz fans and the jazz community, you know, that the term can can grow. It can kind of consume everything. But see, I think that's really important, that it's like, and that's one of the larger points of the book, that it's never just about the sounds. Like, it's always the sounds plus, you know, who you are and where you are in society. And you know, so it's never just the music. It's always both. And I think that's been a consistent thread through the history of the music.
Interestingly, I was speaking to, here in Madison, the owner of the One Jazz Club, Cafe Coda. And, you know, on the facade of the building, it has jazz written on the side. And the owner, Hannah John Taylor, he is a jazz player himself. And he intentionally does not use the word jazz, even though he owns a jazz club. It's on the side of his building because the word is asked to carry so much meaning. And, you know, he opts for the term, he said, either improvisational music or simply just the word music. But I thought that was interesting that even here, a jazz club owner deciding not to use the word, but nevertheless keeping the term for, I think, just advertising purposes.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And right, again, very consistent. I mean, even from the early moments in the music, musicians kind of, some embraced it and many bristled at it. Duke Ellington famously, you know, refused the term. He wanted something broader. And later during other musicians have up to people like Nicholas Payton more recently talk about great black music or, you know, like they've all tried to seek out other ways of describing it. And so for every musician that celebrates the term, and there are plenty who say, you know, jazz is this particular tradition and this these particular musical characteristics and that word is important, there are others who have historically, within jazz musicians themselves, have rejected the term or wanted something broader or different.
And I think that distinction is important throughout the book as well, that something that you were kind of vacillating between is both the critiques outside of the jazz community, those people made up of listeners or critics, but then a lot of these critiques are also within the jazz community as well. So this is something that we see going on throughout the entire work. As your title suggests, your primary approach to jazz is through this intense feeling of hatred. And you talk about all the different ways that hatred gets taken up. It can be actually quite lighthearted, or it can be with a lot of animosity. You know, I hate jazz is a common refrain throughout. And so maybe to kind of set the bedrock for this conversation, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of the theoretical frameworks that you use to study hate, as well as some of its cousins like mockery and disgust, and then how these terms inform something as hard to pin down as taste in music.
Right, right. the project kind of was born, the immediate trigger was the Damien Chazelle movie La La Land, and because the main character, one of the romantic duo, there's Mia and Seb is a jazz musician, and he's portrayed, you know, fairly a bit, maybe a bit stereotypically, but, you know, pretty accurately. Like, he listens to little bits of Thelonious Monk, and he's trying to figure it out, and, you know, I mean, it's treated in a somewhat knowledgeable way, and there's a famous moment in the movie where their love is blossoming, and Mia says, "I hate jazz," and Seb's like, "You know, what do you mean you hate jazz?" And then he drags her to a jazz club in the middle of the day, which I thought, that's great, but I don't know many places you can hear jazz in the middle of the day like that. But so there was just a lot of media reaction to the film and to that moment in particular, because jazz gets kind of featured, and so that, you know, I was interested in that. But at the same time, there was a lot of writing around 2016, around that time, about hate watching and, you know, kind of deliberately or embracing the hate of some sort of form of popular culture, a reality TV show or whatever. And I thought that was interesting as well. And that was sort of the trigger of it. But I was also always fascinated by, because I grew up as a drummer and later a guitarist, and so I've played jazz and never professionally or, you know, with great success. But and so I've always been fascinated by the internal criticism of jazz, because for all the people outside who say they hate it, there's intense arguments within the jazz community. of what constitutes the music, and is it a tradition? Is it a mode of exploration? You know, what is it? You know, those were the things that kind of triggered it. And that what I noticed is that the people who seem to care the most are the people within the music, and that when people say they hate it outside, what seemed worth separating out was a real emotional, you know, like hate in the strongest sense of the word, of like a it's a really powerful emotion. It's a combination of feeling and thinking, and it's composed of hate and of contempt and aggression and all these negative emotions. And but like when Mia says hate, it's more like a taste difference. So I don't like this sweater, or I don't like a flavor of ice cream, you know. So it seemed worth separating out hate as like a really powerful emotion, something that is often linked to really negative things, racism, misogyny, things like that, versus hate as just a very, really strong, like rhetorical way of saying, I don't like things. And once I had that kind of framework, then it made a lot of sense, because then you can kind of trace a story of the reactions to jazz on this kind of continuum of just, I don't like it. It's unpleasant to me. I don't like it, like I don't like, you know, a particular meal for dinner, versus something much stronger. And as I was kind of doing the book, it really was striking that, yes, early on in jazz reception, there was people who really didn't like the music and didn't like it for what it sounded like, but also for the ways it seemed to bring blackness into American society. It seemed to encroach on American norms or expectations of issues of race and things like that, and in a largely segregated world in the teens and 20s and, you know, up to the 50s. And so there was that. But then what was really striking was like how intense, like really intense the emotions are and in within the jazz community. And I ended up, and another starting point for this was I was always fascinated by two moments of internal jazz criticism. And that was Pat Metheny's attack on Kenny G in early 2000, which was something that circulated within the jazz community. Everyone knows this. It's kind of famous. But I was also, I had read the Stanley Crouch essay, a great black critic and scholar, about Miles Davis. And he really just doesn't like anything Miles Davis does from the 60s on. And I found that
which
really
is Davis's because, like, electric period, right? That's when we start to see,
yes,
Davis shift both like the sound as well as his own appearance and aesthetics and self-presentation on the stage as well. So there's not, it seems like there's also some, in Stanley Crouch's particular critique, there's also some latent homophobia, because he, you know, links Davis with Prince as well, and kind of the critique there. And so the intersection of these different kind of, I guess, like value judgments and the types of power hierarchies that they're engaged with.
Yeah, exactly. Crouch and Metheny, like, they're good examples because they're both extremely knowledgeable about the music, and they could be really specific about what they heard. But the thing that bothered him was the meeting of the music with this larger social critique. So for Crouch, it was that this electric Miles Davis, and what he really doesn't like is the stuff he's like in the 80s, really, when he's adopting some pop songs. And you know, I think Davis is trying to meet the new hip hop culture a little bit halfway, you know, and Crouch just really doesn't like it. And it becomes part of a broader critique of what he calls blaxploitation culture of that moment, which embraces elements of the, you know, growing hip hop world. And what he sees is Miles Davis's rejection of a more, I don't know, kind of, rejecting the suits for contemporary clothing or, you know, fashions of the day, and, you know, rejecting a kind of black bourgeois kind of image that he had I don't know if that's the right description, but what I think what's really important is that Crouch, it's like he doesn't like the music, and he's specific about what he doesn't like, but he also doesn't like what it represents, that it's plugged into this larger culture. And Crouch really, the language he uses is really rough, you know, like he turned butt to the beautiful. Crouch says, calls Davis a kind of pimp, a licker of moneyed boots. He has a shriveled soul dancing on stage. And there's this sense of like, of also kind of disgust that like it's showing off a kind of sexuality that's somewhat ambiguous. And that's where he kind of connects it to Prince, who was doing some androgynous kind of elements to his act as well. And so it becomes part, it's like not just the music, it's like the music is a signal for some deeper set of values that he really finds troubling and that he wants to critique. And Pat Metheny does the same thing with Kenny G. It's like at first Kenny G doesn't, you know, Pat Metheny didn't really care. He's like, well, you know, he's not even really a jazz musician is sort of what initially says. But then when Kenny G records this duet with Louis Armstrong singing What a Wonderful World, and, you know, kind of a mashup of a contemporary improvisation with the historical recording, that is this trigger for Metheny. And Metheny just unleashes this. He calls it music necrophilia, that it's disgracing an icon. And again, what was interesting was the musical things that bothered him, but it was really something else, you know, like it was the music plus, it was this sense of desecrating an icon, of clouding the boundaries of what Metheny thinks jazz is. And I think there's different explanations for what was happening. You know, was Metheny, Pat Metheny's always had kind of a foot sort of in the smooth jazz fusion world, and that world has a close connection to pop music, and there's this veneer of kind of selling out or a fear of that, you know. You know, like those two cases are really interesting because both, again, musically specific, but it's really never just about the music. It was about people who they feel betrayed some core value of how they define jazz. And it turns into this something more than just criticism. It becomes like a species of hate, I think.
Would you say primarily within jazz communities, the hatred that goes on, is it primarily around issues of perceived authenticity and upholding the traditions of jazz? It sounds like that's kind of what, from these anecdotes, it's authenticity and tradition.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't really go super deep into authenticity, which is like a core concern of music scholars, and it's really foundational to how we all talk about music. But yes, I think authenticity is really, I think I phrase it in the book more in terms of boundaries, you know. Are you staying within certain boundaries? And I guess it's another, authenticity is just another way of kind of talking about that. But, you know, of course, what is authentic? Is it a kind of neoclassic approach where you know, do repertory versions of Duke Ellington charts or Count Basie charts? And is authenticity being, I mean, the interesting thing about this is that just like how jazz has been defined has changed, like the changing definitions of jazz, the changing notions of authentic jazz, the notions of authenticity in jazz have also changed. So, you know, like you don't have to look very hard. So when, during the 30s, when swing is ascendant, there's this battle between these critics, between the adherents of kind of New Orleans style jazz and big band swing. And it's this really intense kind of verbal battle, a kind of war of words. And what is authentic becomes a kind of a core part of the debate. Is it a kind of musical language of these early New Orleans players? Is it collective improvisation? Is it a certain set of instruments like, you know, a banjo or a tuba versus swing, which is isn't swing more authentic in some ways? You know, so the debate did become, you know, even back then, was about issues of authenticity. And so it kind of relates to the shifting definitions of jazz, or related to the shifting ideas of authenticity. You know, is it improvisation? Is it the place of the blues? Is it a reverence for tradition? Is it an embrace of the new, of you know, always making things new, a kind of modernism of jazz, modernist view of jazz?
You are listening to A Public Affair here on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. I am your host, Andrew Thomas, and on today's show, we're talking about our love-hate relationship with jazz. My guest is Andrew S. Barish, and his new book is Hating Jazz: A History of Its Disparagement, Mockery, and Other Forms of Abuse. This is a pre-recorded show today, so we are not accepting callers. Andrew, we've spoken some about the discourse of hating within jazz circles. Let's kind of take a step out and just a little more broadly, how do folks who do not play jazz music themselves, what do they hate about it? What do most people hate about jazz?
So when you look around and you look in YouTube videos or Reddit forums and things like that, there are a few things that come up again and again. Okay, one, people complain that it's chaotic, that everyone's, I found this quite a lot, but people say everyone's just playing a different song at once, right? And chaotic also means no form. Like, how is this organized? I can't follow this. That's like a standard one. Another common one is it's boring. I can't dance to it. It's too serious. Someone said it's like eating spinach, the idea that it's like somehow good for you. So boring is another. So chaotic is interesting, like when you lay them all out, because chaotic, boring. Another one is that it's not melodic. This is a common one, that there's no, I can't follow the melody. So either there's no singer, or I just don't know, I can't hum anything. I can't sing anything from it. Also common is a recognition that improvisation is important, but a real dislike of it, that it's aimless, it's self-indulgent, it's just a bunch of show-offs, that kind of thing. The final one I found was people comment on the rhythm, that it seems chaotic, unclear, and hard to follow, because jazz tends to avoid, well, certain kinds of jazz tend to avoid strong backbeats, you know, which is the core of a lot of popular music. So those are the standard, like, musical complaints of jazz.
You gave an example of one of my favorite jazz jokes, and it's from the show Parks and Recreation, and they are clearly making fun of NPR. And an NPR jazz show that's coming on is Jazz Plus Jazz Equals Jazz, and it's two different tracks played simultaneously over each other. And I think Leslie Knope was like, oh, that's awful. He's like, yeah, but people love jazz. So... Can you talk to us a little bit more about, like, jazz is often a punchline, but it's often self-aware. You know, you write about how humor played such a fundamental role within jazz. Again, within the jazz community, it seems like they're in on the joke as well. But then also you step outside and it seems like an elitist, urban, you know, cool cat kind of thing that often just seems corny. Can you talk about how humor and a kind of lighter, a more lighthearted hating of jazz, how that's kind of developed through some of the different eras that you look at?
So I'm indebted to other people. A colleague of mine, Charles Garrett, who passed away recently, sadly, but he wrote a really great article about humor and jazz, and he outlines that, and he makes the point that it's always been there. And jazz has always been, this jazz reputation for seriousness is kind of more of a modern development, kind of post-1960s even, you know, maybe post-World War II. But jazz in its emergence was a popular music. It was a commercial music. It was sort of living and dying in the commercial world. And humor was a big part of the selling point. The very first jazz recording, the one that gets labeled as jazz or marked as the first, is the original Dixieland Jazz Band, a white New Orleans group that was recording in the Midwest in 1917, and it's Livery Stable Blues, and it's a blues, but it features braying of barn, and they use their instruments to kind of imitate barn animals. And Louis Armstrong, from very early on, was recording songs that were humorous and had jokes and things like that. So, you know, humor has always been a part of it. Dizzy Gillespie was famous for incorporating humor into songs and skits on stage and all kinds of elements of his playing. And so it's always kind of been part of jazz. Over time, jazz accumulates certain stereotypes, certain, you know, that it's a hip urban music. And because of that, it lended itself to making fun. And sometimes jazz musicians understood it that way. You know, by the bebop era, you have berets and sunglasses and a hipster language. So that's always been a source of humor, both within and outside the jazz community.
A direction I'd kind of like to move in from this lighter, more humorous take is also thinking about how, as you've reminded us, like, it's never just about the music. These tastes that we develop, the taste that we develop for certain types of music, it's completely bound up in social relations, in power hierarchies like racism, colonialism, misogyny, homophobia, etc. And it's never just about the music. In a couple of different sections in the book, you talk about the concerns about with popular music, and specifically its link to fascism. You bring up the one writer, Theodore Adorno, who was very concerned with jazz as he was kind of seeing the effects of fascism in the mid-20th century. And he was really concerned that jazz was a vehicle for that. And I was really fascinated to read about the real concerns of jazz and swing, and that people thought that these were mechanisms of fascism. So could you just tell us a little bit more about that history and how popular music was taken quite seriously and seen as a real threat to the status quo?
Yeah. So Theodor Adorno was a German philosopher and part of a group of philosophers that we call the Frankfurt School. And they were exiled from Germany during when the Nazis came to power, and many came to the United States. And Adorno came to the United States and continued to write and work here. And he it was a philosopher, but he wrote a lot about music. And within the jazz scholarship world, popular music studies more generally, Adorno looms very large because he had this philosophical rigor and this complicated ideas about popular culture. And he wrote a lot about music. He was also a trained composer and studied with Alban Berg and was very, very knowledgeable. Adorno is kind of the most famous jazz hater, at least among academics, because he wrote several essays about it. And so jazz scholars have tried to wrestle with, like, well, what did this really sophisticated philosopher, why did he hate jazz so much? And there's a lot of debate. Some people say, well, did he really hear the good stuff? And maybe he just heard, you know, watered down versions of jazz in the 30s and 40s. You know, did he hear Duke Ellington and what did he think of that, for example? But Adorno's critique is really part of a larger critique of commercial culture, popular culture, what he and another philosopher, Horkheimer, would call the culture industry. And so they saw the creation of popular music as a kind of variant of a capitalist production, like you manufacture automobiles, you kind of manufacture music. And they recognize that it's different than a product, but that things become standardized, and you're giving the audience what they want with a little bit of novelty, but not enough to really challenge them. And the fear here was that popular culture could be used to further fascism or authoritarianism, that popular culture was a kind of was a method of control, of social control. And so jazz, being the popular music of the moment that they're writing these things in the 30s, 40s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, jazz becomes the focus of the attack. But Adorno also hated lots of things he thought were deluding you or obscuring things of the way things really work, you know, because Adorno thought, you know, music could be a conveyor of certain truth, and the truth of of the way capitalism shapes and damages us and leads to terrible political and social things. So his critique of jazz is part of this like much larger, complicated critique of, you know, modern culture. But what's interesting is the fear of music and social control goes really deep. And so when I talked earlier of like when people hate jazz, and I went through the musical things, there's also, again, always more than that. So what some people hate jazz, like in the 30s and 40s when it was equivalent or analogous to popular music, was that it was mass produced. And it's similar to the Adorno critique. And you had lots of critics in the 30s say swing music is just, it's just a commercial product and it's deluding you and it's just giving you what you want. It's not challenging you. And it's just getting you to buy more music, or, you know, it's just part of the system. So, you know, there people would attack jazz as we could call these production arguments. The scholar Simon Frith kind of talks about it this way, that music is bad, not just for what it sounds like, but for the way it's made, that it, you know, it's part of a bad system and it's corrupt and it's fooling you. Sometimes jazz was criticized for the effects that it had on you, that, and this is especially early on in the teens and 20s, that jazz was leading to sexual deviancy or juvenile delinquency or social disease of some kind that's poisoning society. And then music was also critiqued, jazz, not just for the music, but for like a lack of craft, that it's, you know, there are real people playing real music out there and not these hacks who just make funny sounds on their instruments. You know, that was a common critique. The very high level kind of philosophizing of Adorno has an interesting parallel in the debate, for example, in the swing era between swing and early jazz. People call this debate the moldy figs. It was a term of labeled at these conservative critics who didn't like swing. And it spills into the bebop era or modern jazz. And one of the aspects of that debate wasn't just about like what is jazz or what is authentic jazz. It had this larger social concern. And that was that a lot of the early swing components saw swing era jazz as proto-fascist, as authoritarian, and that that it was all these youth were you know, because we forget a little bit that swing was a fad like early rock and roll, where it was a youth culture and there was dancing and people storming stages, Benny Goodman on stage and things like that. And so there was a fear that the music was brainwashing people, that they were overcome with emotion and unable to think rationally. And in the context of especially the 1930s, this was of great concern. And so people like critics like Rudy Blesch, they see this as proto-fascist. And even Benny Goodman expressed horror at the jitterbugs. You know, he's playing this music and he sees this like what seemed out of control, like, you know, their eyes bugging out and they're dancing, and he, you know, and he at some level is, you know, works really hard at his music and wants people to enjoy it and, you know, be really, you know, like dance, you know, and when he sees such uncontrolled passion, like even Benny Goodman's a little horrified. So the Adornian debate, it has this kind of real world or this real historical parallel in the actual discussions of jazz at the time, that it's not just that this music might be bad or that it might be commercial, but that it's so emotionally overpowering that it could, you know, make people lose their minds and behave badly, or make them susceptible to social control or authoritarian governments and things like that.
It's so interesting to hear that concern, a kind of U.S.-based concern, because then you write in your final chapter on the ethics of hating jazz, you talk about how jazz was also spurned by Nazis and the Soviets at various points. And then it seemed like at other points there was kind of a more ambivalent relationship with it. But can you talk about how these authoritarian regimes also didn't like it?
So within jazz scholarship, Adorno, everyone sort of has to deal with him because he's a really sophisticated thinker, and he was strongly anti-fascist and was Marxist in orientation. The other great examples of jazz hating are, we usually cite the Nazi regime and the Soviet regime. But as they're great scholars of both of these things, and what you quickly see is their attitude rhetorically might be really negative. You know, this is, in the Nazi case, degenerative. The rhetoric is anti-Semitic, it's racist. But in reality, their attitude toward the music was quite pragmatic. And they would use the music if they felt it would build morale or further, you know, their cause. That was definitely the case in Nazi Germany. They had white jazz bands or playing a version of jazz. Again, the definition's fuzzy, but they were playing something that was understood as jazz. So it existed, and it was treated as like, you know, we'll denounce it here, but, you know, it might be useful here. So, and in the Soviet Union, it ebbed and flowed because, interestingly, the Soviets sort of recognized that it was it had its origins in black life and in the history of slavery and oppression, and it spoke a language of freedom. And so that fits well with the ideology. But at the same time, it was also commercial music. And so it represented bourgeois capitalism, right? And so the fate of jazz there kind of ebbs and flows as well, depending on how they felt it could be used or the regime, current regime, and how they felt about the message it sent.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, by the time we're into the 1950s and 60s and well into the Cold War, we see the official U.S. stance towards jazz. It's very different because we have the U.S. Jazz Ambassadors Program, and we have jazz kind of being exported around the world to show what a great American and democratic product it is. And so we really see it become a tool of Cold War politics.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the same music that we were afraid was, you know, proto-fascist could get sort of co-opted or adopted by the U.S. State Department as an engine of, you know, anti-communist propaganda. And of course, there's great work on this too. You know, the musicians, mostly black musicians, were fully aware of the contradictions of what this meant, you know, living in a society that was still segregated, that was dominated by, you know, racial discrimination, and they're supposed to be promoting American freedom, and, you know, so they understood that. It's a good example of how the meanings of jazz can change and be used in different contexts. It's not kind of a single thing.
Definitely. In your final chapter, you make a turn to think about how hate can be a politically progressive act. You talk about in ways in which hate can rally feelings and rally emotions in such a way that it can kind of form a collective, and that there's a potential for progressive action to happen. Can you tell us a little bit more about this as a concept, and then how you see it interacting with the argument that you've been making so far?
Because the project was kind of born in this moment where there was a lot of talk about hate watching and, you know, hating, loving to hate something. And that was really interesting to me. And, you know, you start to wonder, like, hate has this thing where it's both associated with the worst parts of our natures, right? Racism, misogyny, violence, you know, all these terrible things. But then we use it every day, all the time, to talk about everything, you know. So that ambiguity, it plays a part here because, well, there are people, and there have been philosophers and cultural critics, and I talk about them, who have seen hating certain things can be a way to bring people together. If you think something is, I don't know, socially destructive, and you know, hate is such a powerful emotion, and you can get people to come together through this dislike of something, you can kind of build a community. And certain music, there are elements of of punk, definitely other sorts of subcultural musics, which are built around a kind of rejection of something else, of a mainstream culture or something. And that can turn into a kind of hate, maybe not in the strongest sense, but a sense of, again, about boundaries, like, that's not us. You know, we're not sellouts. We have authenticity. We have integrity. We believe in values that we can't compromise. And that can, you know, a lot of people have written about this, that that's a really positive thing. It brings people together and kind of focuses people's energies and attention. The great Black scholar Bell Hooks talked about militant rage and understanding racial oppression as a way of as a mode of organizing and transcending injustice in society. And, you know, I find it very compelling and interesting. But in the end, hate always has this thing. It always drifts toward making the fluid world that we live in and the ambiguous world we live in into very fixed things. And it tends to boil down something to like a one, you know, a kind of undesirable trait or characteristic. It tends to kind of fix things. And that always seems kind of dangerous. So like hating jazz, and this is particularly true in the chapter about making fun of jazz, like if making fun of jazz is like a species of hating jazz, and it's not that it you shouldn't do it. I mean, jazz deserves satire. Everything, you know, satire is a very healthy thing. It unveils foolish cultural behaviors and you know, character faults and things like that. But hating something, when it drifts toward the stronger thing, it tends to efface the ambiguities and things like that. And it often shifts into a rejection of people. And that's what worries me. And that's the thing I with the jazz humor, it became very clear that it was mostly white comedians or white people making fun of jazz. And I didn't find too many, if any, of people within the Black community doing that.
You said, you write a number of times about the trope also of like a white critic taking down jazz specifically. That has a historical precedent within jazz culture as well.
Yeah. And if you accept that, and again, it's not that you can't criticize it, but it's sort of the mode of criticism or what you're doing, because if you're really attacking jazz, and I give examples just in the popular press, journalists and critics and jazz, some of the things I've said, it's boring and has no focus, and, you know, it's the music of Starbucks, you know, things like that. And that's fine. I mean, but what, there is this interesting ambiguity though, because what are you hating? Just hating the sounds? But again, it's never just the sounds. And that leads you down pretty soon. You're like, are you hating this element of Black culture? You know, are you attacking white appropriators of this? Are you attacking these stereotypes? And it's just that hate kind of leads you, it seems to me, inevitably to a kind of personal attack, a sort of social argument about people you don't like. Like, I wrote about jazz, but I think it's applicable. And I try to drop in moments where I say, you know, like the attack on disco was a good example in the 70s and late 70s, early 80s. And the attack on disco is often done in a kind of humorous way with DJs affecting effeminate voices and, you know, talking about how it's just repetitive and it's just, you know, but like, it wasn't too hard. You didn't have to scratch the surface to understand that it was kind of homophobic and racist at the same time, because this was a music kind of born in Black and queer nightclubs, and it was a music like really important to these people. And you didn't like the music, but then you're making fun of it, and it all got, I mean, it wasn't actually so ambiguous maybe in disco's case, but I think with jazz, it does get kind of ambiguous, and it kind of bleeds, I think, uncomfortably close to kind of a rejection of people. And that's the interesting thing about taste, is like we think we're always just like, I don't like this film because of the story or the plot. But there's, and the philosopher Kant many, many, many years ago made this point that when you make a taste judgment, you are also kind of implicitly asking, like, if I don't like this, like, what kind of person likes this? You know, it becomes a kind of social judgment. as well.
Taste is tied to certain values that we have, and we don't necessarily always connect the two because we think taste is simply, oh, I just don't like this song, but there's a lot of potentially unconscious values that we're attaching to these taste choices that are informed by, again, like larger histories and kind of structures.
Exactly.
Something I'm curious about as well is you and probably the final pages of the book, you're thinking about jazz reception today and where it's at. And something that we've been witnessing for probably about the last decade or so, you don't write about this, but, you know, we've seen this boom in vinyl sales, you know, and so record stores are very popular places now. I should disclose that, you know, I DJ here in town and I do a monthly jazz set at a listening lounge. And so there is definitely certain demographics where jazz is still very hot. And we're seeing people return to these older forms of media and rediscovering music in new ways. Where is the state of jazz now? Is it really just the listening purview of middle-aged white guys or how diverse is jazz listenership in 2025?
You know, it's funny, when I was doing this, the book I didn't want to write was like How Not to Hate Jazz, you know, I wanted to make sure it was a history and not like kind of a diagnostic manual, you know, so people, you know, like, you know, because at some level, I do love the music and all its variety and forms, and I try to play it, and it's really, really important to me. But on the other hand, I'm not a critic, really. So I don't know what my responsibility is to, you know, at a deep level, you want the music to live on and grow and things like that. But I didn't want to be prescriptive in any way. But inevitably, right, in the book, you sort of have to confront this, right? Like, what is the state of it today? And my small contribution to this debate, which is an active debate among every jazz educator and fan, and what struck me most, I think, was not that jazz is hated, that there are manifestations of it, but when you look, there have been some polling. There's a 2005 National Endowment of the Arts poll of musical preferences, and there was an earlier one that another jazz scholar, Scott DeVoe, did. And what was interesting about both those, and they're a little dated now, but I think there's some truth even to the present. It's like that the problem with jazz seems to be not that people hate it, but that they just don't have much feeling about it at all. Like there's just not much emotional attachment. And there was this funny poll by this polling firm in 2015, and it was they're like a political polling firm, but they did this sort of humorous one about what music. It ended up being about musical preferences. And what they came out with was, you know, like people really hate someone like Justin Bieber, you know, like if you ask them, like, who do you hate, you know, and like popular music has this kind of, it seems to speak to the moment, both sonically and socially, right? It speaks to issues of gender and race and politics and things like that. Whereas jazz doesn't have that affect, that emotional way it grips you. Right. And when you look at these polls, jazz people are like, jazz is OK. You know, like it always kind of falls in the middle of these polls. Like, I kind of like it. So, you know, people will hear jazz or maybe they'll study, you know, I have college students and they'll study to it or something. And it's like they don't hate it or anything. They just don't seem to care too much about it. And what those polls also found is that it still has a strong following within the Black community, broadly defined. And that there's still a lot of live attendance at jazz events. It still plays an important part in Black culture. And actually, the recent Grammy Awards tribute to Quincy Jones is like a really good example of its place in Black music, but popular music more generally. It was at the Grammys in 2025, they did a tribute to Quincy Jones, this great, he was a jazz musician and arranger, but a really amazing producer and did everyone from Frank Sinatra to Michael Jackson. And they did a tribute, and they did Stevie Wonder and Herbie Hancock did Bluesette, which is like a jazz standard. And then Cynthia Erivo did, I think, Fly Me to the Moon. And it was an interesting moment. And the audience, clearly, it was this great moment, and the performances were great. And like no one seemed to hate it. And it just showed you like that jazz does have this relevance in this. It's inextricably kind of intertwined with American popular music, and it's very still has this really important part component of Black American culture and Black popular music as well. And so the issue with jazz today seems not so much like, yes, I think education's important, and I think more live music is important, and sure, it'd be great, and I know musicians would really like this if there were greater digital or CD sales and, you know, greater streaming of the music. But what seems, so again, my small contribution to this is that it seems like if you want people to care, it's not just that you make great music and that people will just come to it. Even if you tell them it's great, it kind of has to have that emotional capture of you, right? It has to grip you in a way and speak to the current moment. And I think there are different ways you can do this. There are all kinds of jazz fusions with hip hop and electronic music and avant-garde music. And there's all different ways that it's happening today. There are ways jazz was sort of plugged into Black Lives Matter, and it took on a kind of political urgency and connecting to Black history. And that seems like a way to do it. Even the Grammys, not the most forward-looking institution, has a best alternative jazz category, which I think within the jazz world is a little odd, you know, because it's not a term I think people use very much. But to me, that actually seemed kind of good and promising. And that category was filled with lots of interesting artists that you normally wouldn't associate with jazz or are kind of adjacent to what we think of as jazz. So the key issue seems to me is that, you know, I guess it's really, you know, how to make it relevant, but it's more than relevant. It's like, it's that emotional impact, you know, that it speaks. Like in the 30s, swing was not only just popular music, but it spoke to that immediate moment of like, who are our youth and what are they going to be? And where is America stand in the world? You know what I mean? Like it had this like really great importance, you know, and in the Cold War, jazz seemed to be this like, yes, it was declining in popularity, but it embodied American individualism and like all the, you know, these complicated things. And it became like something you could argue about. And jazz doesn't quite have that today. I mean, maybe it does. And maybe that's what we need to talk about. The journalist Phil Freeman wrote a book about jazz that was very helpful to me. And he kind of breaks it into zones of activity, and Chicago being one locus, Los Angeles. New York has always been the jazz center, but it's there's lots of different scenes, you know, there, lots of different music. And there's European scenes, and increasingly there's jazz in Latin America and growing scenes that are having international importance. And it's all very exciting. And I think, yeah, it's helpful to see it in that broad way of like all this activity going on. I'm not so pessimistic. I think people are always kind of drawn to this music for the things it offers and you know, ways of thinking and being. And it's, you know, it's always been a way to open people to other cultures, whether it's whites into Black cultural practices or American jazz musicians to, say, Brazilian music. You know, jazz has always been this way of kind of opening these doors. So I think the music will survive instead of picking winners and losers, you know.
Well, I think it's very good to end on an affirmative note for a discussion around hating jazz. Today, I've been in conversation with Andrew S. Barish about his brand new book, Hating Jazz, A History of Its Disparagement, Mockery, and Other Forms of Abuse, published this year by the University of Chicago Press. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed this.
I have been Andrew Thomas, and you have been listening to A Public Affair. Keep it tuned here to your community-sponsored station, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded.
Listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Up next is Madison Bookbeat. We are rebroadcasting a conversation from last summer between Jade Isiri Ramos and author Elizabeth Holden. Enjoy.
are the mainstream. Media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Ha ha. Mike and Marie.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen, who's been the front-runner for the presidential election in 2 years' time, will now not be able to stand after a court found her guilty of embezzlement. Ms. Le Pen was sentenced to 4 years in prison, half of it suspended for diverting European parliamentary allowances. She's banned from running for public office for 5 years. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
For the party that she runs, the Hard Right National Rally, the sentence was a travesty, a clear sign, in their view, that the judiciary is in cahoots with the political establishment to keep